When the final report of the Harper Review of Competition Policy landed with a thud last month, there was huge focus, if you recall, on the implications for business, for retailers, taxis, chemists and the like. But largely overlooked were its extensive recommendations around competition and choice for people using health and medical, employment and community services, very basic services we probably take for granted. Sue McCluskey, a member of the Harper Review panel, will explain why she thinks it'll be a game changer for consumers and government in just a few moments. But first, let's take a look at an example of what is possible and how it could work. Canberra's National Health Co-op provides affordable medical and health services, and Blake Wilson is Deputy and Director and Deputy Chair, and he's with me now. Welcome, Blake.
Thanks so much.
Blake, the National Health Co-op had its beginnings when parents in West Belconnen, I understand, couldn't find affordable local GPs. Now, I know it's much more than that now, but how does it work?
It actually did start when there was a big shortage of GPs in the local area. And that resulted from a number of small GP clinics closing down. You know, the practitioners retired or they were bought out by larger practices. So the co-op started up and basically reopened a number of those practices. So it works by a member joining up. They pay an annual joining fee. Mm-hmm. And for that, they
which
get
access.
Which is
what, by the way?
It's either $10 a month or $100 a year.
Gosh.
Yeah, so return on investment we look at has to be one or two visits, and it certainly meets that. So for that joining fee, they get access to bulk bill doctors at any of our five current clinics. They get access to psychology services. We've got dietitians on hand. We have diabetes educator on hand. And they also have access to our nurses and nurse practitioners.
And what about the rates you pay your doctors? Now, would that be noticeably different from the way they might work outside the co-op?
Not at all. The doctors are remunerated very much and comparably with what they would get at any other practice. So from that perspective, it's very similar.
It seems a thriving community model and obviously reflects a basic requirement that innovation has to spring from people themselves to fill a need. Now, is that one of the conclusions that you've drawn?
Yeah, that was really what kicked this off. So when the problem was identified and the community was agitating for someone to come and fix it, it was realised pretty quickly that no one's going to come and fix it and the community needed to get together and do it themselves.
Were there a couple of real activists who drove this? I'm always fascinated by the answer to this question.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the action coalesced around three major groups, and that's the local chemist who was getting sick of people coming in and complaining and thinking, okay, we have to do something here. The president of the neighbourhood watch, for obvious reasons there, and certainly the local primary schools, PNC, they were the kind of the three groups that really carried this through.
One of your aims is to reinvest money in primary healthcare. It's a stated goal, I gather.
Yes.
Why so?
The model that works or has operated for many years where GP clinics are managed privately and then the surplus funds, you know, the profit is returned to the shareholder, is less than desirable for the community when it comes to primary health. So the model we have is there is no dividend that is paid. All profits are retained and those are reinvested in the operation and expansion of the model. We reinvest the surplus revenue in things like diabetes education. We have healthy eating programs and we continue to expand throughout the city. And for instance, we're looking over the next sort of 12 months to put an extra three or four clinics in the ACT and then start expanding into regional New South Wales and ultimately through the whole country.
My God, oh, it's empire building. And I'm told you have things like breakfast clinics for drug addicts and at bus shelters. Is that right?
Absolutely. So we participate in an early morning centre which addresses homelessness needs in the population, and we provide medical services for those people free of charge.
Why isn't there more of this? I mean, it does sound like a true win-win.
Well, it takes a unique set of circumstances where you have a population that is not only has a need but has a willingness to do something about it and can coalesce all the right motivated people, those with the right skills, and get the whole business community on board. Anybody could replicate this, but it requires those motivated individuals to give up a huge amount of their free time and actually do that.
And just remind us, and you may have said this at the top and I've forgotten, why did your clinics close down in the first place? Why did the private providers close down?
Obviously, some doctors who own their own clinics might decide to retire, and that's obviously completely up to them, and they're allowed to do that. And the other option that is a big driver of closures is when the GP super clinics grab in the doctors. They obviously make it very lucrative for them to close up shop, move into a centralised practice, and that actually really strips communities of their GP.
Incidentally, are yours multiple doctor clinics or one?
Absolutely. All of our clinics have at least three GPs.
Well, look, thank you, Blake Wilson. Obviously, you're enjoying it immensely. I can hear it in your voice. And we'll probably hear more of you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now, Sue McCluskey, you've been listening. Is this the sort of innovation that you say is already open to people? If so, what's stopping more communities from doing this?
We certainly see this as a great opportunity for more innovation because competition brings choice and choice brings diversity and diversity does bring that innovation. But firstly, can I say, Geraldine, I'm really glad you're talking to us about this because I'd have to say that as a member of the Harper panel, out of the 56 recommendations that we put forward in that review on competition policies, laws and institutions, we saw the real game changer as being the recommendation to really open up the area of human services to competition. And just the fact that it's putting consumer choice at the very heart of competition and what it's able to do is to be able to say we can have greater improvements. We can actually increase our productivity that's driven by this competition, and that has the potential to deliver huge gains across the community.
And yet it hasn't been reported, really, has it?
No, it hasn't. It hasn't. You know, the media has really picked up on things, as you said, like the pharmacies and like the taxis and the supermarkets, but this is the really big national agenda that we should be talking about, and I'm really pleased we're starting to now.
Your report said that given the size of the sector, and it's only going to grow, even small improvements will have profound impacts on people's standard of living and quality of life. Now, are you just asserting this? Have you seen examples during this exercise of inquiry?
Well, what we've said is it's actually the human services sector that is actually going to be growing because, of course, we've got an ageing population, and the human services includes health, education, community services, which includes aged care, disability care. So those needs are going to continue to grow. And what we've said is by opening this up to competition, you will have private providers, you'll have government providers, you'll have not-for-profit and volunteer providers. And we've said it's really important that you don't crowd out the not-for-profit and volunteer sector. They really can provide so much in terms of the added benefits. Let me give you an example that we heard as we were going through the review. It was providing meals to homeless people in Melbourne, and it was a small church-based organisation that provided these meals. You know, there was a change of tender that came up, and they actually lost the tender, and there was a big organisation that came in. Now, those homeless people still got the meals, but what they didn't get was someone to sit beside them and listen to them and talk to them. So it's really important that we actually say one size doesn't fit all, and we've actually got to look at, with greater competition, we've got the opportunity to have different models, but that is really focused on outcomes. What are the outcomes we want that are really going to be the best for people? How can they choose what they want, not what government wants for them, that this fits their own model?
You do say, though, that you feel that the Australian governments ought to adopt some guiding principles on this, ought to be the stewards of it, to test innovative ways of delivering services. How would you like to see that happen?
Well, certainly through pilots and trials. And we're seeing that at the moment with the National Disability Services, so NDIS. And that's really important because it's important to be able to learn from how some of these innovations will work in different regions, how they will work under different service delivery models. It's also important that government has that oversight role because they really need to make sure that the policy outcomes are achieved. But we do see that you need to separate the funding of these services from the actual delivery, the providers of these services. So we've also made recommendations around separating this so that you don't actually have the interests of the regulator and the policymaker the same as the interests of the provider.
Now, I don't understand. What do you mean by that?
So what we mean is at the moment, if you have government that's actually making the policy, providing the money, but also delivering the services, you actually don't have a separation of getting the best service because you're actually looking at funding. So what may happen is you may actually look for the cheapest option, for example. Whereas if you can actually separate that, you can actually really focus on what are the outcomes so that the provider is focused on getting the best service delivery for the people who need it and the funds are going to make sure that you do get those best outcomes. So we see it's very important to separate the funding of these services from the actual provision itself.
What I suppose I'm still a little bit intrigued by is, if I get you correctly, it's the not-for-profit groups coming into this space. In other words, we've probably got very used to the idea that it's not government only who provides good human services, but the assumption has been it's best now to bring for-profit in. People can debate it, but that's been the nostrum. You're saying that your inquiries showed that there was another whole group with a different set of motives who can be the game changers?
Well, look, what our report says is that we should open this up. So we haven't necessarily said this should go to any one group. We're really saying that that one size doesn't fit all. So by opening it up, it allows you to have the choice between private providers, not-for-profit providers, and there might be, you know, government providers. There is room for this. We've also got to look at where you can have more choice. So, for example, in those metropolitan areas in the bigger regional cities, you've got far better ability to get greater choice than you would in the more rural and remote areas. And that may be where the government really has to be the provider, because perhaps private sector providers may be less likely to go in and deliver those services.
So you could have market failure in the regions if you're not careful.
And that indeed is the role of government. The role of government is to be able to enable, and where we have that competition, they should be able to step back and allow that competition to continue. But where you may not be able to get that level of competition, then there could be a need for things such as community service obligations. That means that government does need to come in and say, well, we need to make sure that we can provide the minimum level of services that we believe is acceptable.
I mean, this is not a new dilemma for government, is it? Is what you're talking about really about providing cheaper services? Are they better or are they just less expensive?
Well, you know, that's why we're saying let's focus on outcomes, because it's not necessarily cheaper if you're actually not getting the sort of outcomes you want, because particularly when you look at the area of human services, if you're not actually delivering good health care, it's actually going to cost you in the long
ultimately
run.
Ultimately more.
Yes. So we shouldn't really be focusing just on the cheapest. We would expect with greater competition, you will get lower price.
Very interesting to hear, see where this might go, Sue McCluskey, and I'll very much invite listeners to let us know whether they've witnessed this and their own experiences. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sue is a member of the Harper Review panel. She's also the CEO of the Regional Australia Institute. Blake Wilson is the director of the Australian Health Cooperative in Canberra, which provides affordable medical and health services, and he's deputy chair as well.